afternoon, the Clinton Bank will lastly look at the local government fiscal framework, a bit of overview on what's not being addressed around the free basic services as well as the inclining block tariff. The broader picture for the provision of electricity services lies both from a municipal owned revenue side for rates and taxes as well as service charges, but also from grants and transfers from national government, which largely relates to the equitable share as well as provincial and national operating grants. This allows for the capital budget of the municipality to be developed and is also, as you can see...
Do we have a presentation?
I do have a presentation. Do other members have presentations? Thank you very much.
Thank you. The transfers are supported also by indirect transfers in the case of electricity to the ESCOM. And I'll just address some of the matters raised by the FFC in this regard later. So the whole of this fiscal framework is designed to support the distribution function. Basically, on the equity side, we have provided for the free basic services to be funded through the equitable share. Just to note that we do make provision for increasing prices into the equitable share. Not to the extent, if you go and compare the increase in the equitable share to the increase in the electricity price, it is going to be largely different, but that's because of the historical underpricing of electricity, and also not that the equitable share doesn't pay for the whole electricity, obviously, it's a portion thereof. However, I have to be clear that this function cannot be funded completely out of a taxable income, and that the tariffs relating to the income from electricity services must be used for the ongoing operations and maintenance of the network. And also, as we know, there are some provisions in that to help with cost subsidization. Now, the equitable share itself has grown substantially since 2006-07. So if we look 3 years ago and we look forward, we'll see there's been massive real growth in the equitable share towards municipalities. And these are largely supported through the growth in conditional grants as well. So there's been quite a large increase in the grants towards electricity. And you'll know there's been an introduction of a fuel levy sharing mechanism. So we see the equitable share grow from just under 30 billion to a 70 billion transfer if you combine the equitable share and the conditional grants. In addition to that, there's been some policy reforms to help with municipal reporting and budgeting. The Treasury is working quite steadfastly on ensuring that we are able to consolidate the municipal budgeting into a standardized format. And there's also been allocations to support transfers from national. So where there are transfers, there's been support for financial management and sometimes operational management in the municipality. There's also been some specific capacity systems in terms of support towards planning and budgeting, support towards operations in the case of Santa Manji. And I do think, the committee chair, you were right that COCTA can play quite a role in this area because of the role that is now taken over the Santa Manji project in terms of the Municipal Infrastructure Support Agency. I think it can be useful to get a sense of where we're going with that level of support. Now, the demand for capital infrastructure remains high. We see specifically in metros and secondary cities that there is a large need for growth. This is obviously fueled by economic growth, but also migration into those areas. So you'll see the red block, which is the growth part. But obviously also because there's a lot of growth and The existing infrastructure networks are large. The need for rehabilitation is substantial within our metropolitan and secondary cities. Compared to the rural municipalities, where you can see it is the backlogs component is obviously still a large component, but also the rehabilitation side of the expenditure is quite critical. The capital funding is currently funded by 51% is a transfer from national. That was the number in 2010-11, whereas external loads contributed 27% towards the funding, and this has actually declined. So the ability of municipalities to use their income from the service to raise debt to invest in more infrastructure is on the decline, and obviously that is a significant part of how we can fund this kind of investments, and that we need to be ensuring that we don't lose that. I'm sorry if it's a bit vague at the bottom, but you can see now that the public sector lending into the sector has exceeded the private sector lending, and this is largely driven by the role of the Development Bank of South Africa, who has been supporting municipalities quite significantly. But it also does speak to the risk, and we'll speak to why this is seen as a risky area for investment. I think the main three matters. Firstly, is that municipalities' budgets are not realistic. We find an overestimation of revenues and an underestimation of costs, largely. So that leads to the capital budgets being overly ambitious because they suspect there will be more money forthcoming and that what it will actually cost to provide for the infrastructure will be less. So that is a key thing that needs to be addressed, and that speaks to the financial management as well as the information on what is being done, how much is being costed, and good asset management systems to support that. On the asset management, the second problem is the current maintenance. Obviously, we know there's a skills problem, but there's also the basic systems of putting in place the asset management system can be improved, and the expenditure, focusing and prioritizing expenditure on maintenance and rehabilitation, and can make a large difference. And then what we find is a problem is where you spend on emergency maintenance. So you basically wait until something breaks and then spend money to fix that. The cost of that expenditure is much higher than a preventative maintenance program, which can also bring down the cost over time. And also, we were speaking about disruptions. Some of the members mentioned disruptions. Obviously, if you do preventative maintenance, you are much more likely to minimize those. As I indicated, the own funding in terms of capital budget need to be increased. We see an increasing reliance on national funding through grants and transfers. And that the operating budgets and tariffs that the municipalities put forward are not making provision to fund the capital that they need. And obviously, when you don't have proper pricing, then the banks are not going to be forthcoming in terms of helping you with investment in capital. So I think the key message here has been that what we are concerned about is where we see increased costing or increased transfers towards local government for these basic functions, you see a decrease in their own investment. So the pot stays the same. It's just that the taxpayer is now paying more and the electricity user is paying less. Or they might all be paying more, but the money is not being spent on electricity, which I'll highlight in a second. So the first thing is to get the basics right and to ensure that your revenue management is in place, that the proper billing information goes out, that it's accurate, and that there is an ability in the municipality to collect for these funds. In total, by end of December 2010, municipalities were owed a total of 62 billion rand. Now, that is not a sustainable way to provide services. And the problem is we are seeing this increase. It's not a decreasing trend. We haven't really found ways to turn this boat around. As I said, we're concerned that even though the Minister of Citizens Act says that, you know, we must properly price for a cost-reflective tariff, we are not seeing this happen. And then when we cut spending on maintenance, it has a longer-term impact that we will struggle to fund. There were some issues raised during the morning around the performance of inability to collect tariffs, illegal connections, and some of the distribution losses you can see are way above 10%. I think somebody was mentioning 6 or 5 is the international standard. You can see some municipalities are seeing very, very large losses in terms of what they're supposed to be collecting. Now, electricity currently uses the largest proportion of the equitable share, and it is growing if you compare it to refuse as well as water and sanitation. It takes up a large proportion of expenditure for the equitable share. There are other funding streams that are quite significant. The Integrated National Electrification Program, which provides the connection to the household as opposed to the ongoing cost, will be spending just over 10 billion rand over the medium-term expenditure framework for 2012. And we are planning to get about 200,000 households, 6 bulk stations, this is per annum, 10 additional stations, 350 kilometers of new voltage lines, medium voltage lines, and 200 kilometers of existing lines being upgraded. In addition to this, and apologies for not putting it on the slide, there are the funding towards off-grid, which is about 274 million over the MTEF. And then obviously there are also allocations to municipalities for the demand side management replacement of light bulbs, robots that don't go out when the lights go out. And that's about 600 million over the MTF. And then there's been a very large allocation towards the solar water geyser program that will be managed by Eskom of just under 5 billion, actually it's 4.7 billion over the MTF to get to the president's million households with solar water geysers. So there's a lot of support largely for the capital investment in this area. And therefore, as we indicate, it's quite important that the operational side is looked after properly and that we see a balance between the revenue collection side and the expenditure side. Our preliminary reviews is that about 20 billion more is collected out of electricity than what is spent on electricity. So what we collect every year on all municipalities is 20 billion more than what we spend on electricity. And that is a phenomenon that we need to find ways to address. Now, the way not to address it is to put the price up for everybody and then the poor can't afford it. So that is why the free basic electricity policy comes into the field. And I'm not going to go into this too much because I think all of this has been said. I think what is important, though, is that the Treasury does adjust the free basic electricity component of the local equitable share in line with the bulk tariff. So, for instance, in 2010, when Eskom increased the bulk tariff, another 6.7 billion was added to the local equitable share to support municipalities in that payment. So we are not running behind. We didn't forget to adjust the formula for the price. It is reflective. And as you saw when we started the presentation, there's been quite significant growth in the local equitable share. So, yes, we do use the Census 2001. That is the census that the Treasury can work with. But with growth that is far beyond our population growth and far beyond the growth rates that we see in the economy, The impact of that is negligible. So, you know, we are not behind population growth, or even if you take migration into account, the equitable share would have grown beyond those numbers. So we do think this is more a budgeting problem than a money problem, but then I'm sure you would think that, we would think that in any case. The key things are to ensure that we provide access. I think Eskom has raised some issues that we now need to get to rural areas, and it becomes more costly and difficult. But also to keep on maintaining that access, and I think that is a key area that everybody is concerned about in terms of the distribution infrastructure and where we are with that. But also, obviously, is a growth in consumption, and at some point you need to understand that these households are moving into a growth area and no longer a backlog area, so that we do ensure where there is a consumption that is able to pay for services that we bring them into the field. I'm a bit concerned about the differences in numbers between ourselves and the Department of Energy, and I'm hoping we just counted different stuff, because our view is that from the number of consumer units receiving basic electricity service, we are seeing the free basic services containing 35% of those. And I think the department mentioned 60-something, 69%. Which sounds enormously high. It's not the same story. So this is in terms of basic electricity consumer units, which we said is our households, and we are now seeing this up to 35. Now, there are some concerns as to whether this is a sustainable number, and I think some people have mentioned during the morning that we need to understand where households are receiving these benefits who might not be entitled to them. And I think that will be a good exercise to go through. We are seeing our revenues grow, we are seeing our expenditure grow, but as I said, the difference between them is still quite large. The problem with the expenditure is we're not seeing capital expenditure grow. We are seeing a decline over the MTEF of 14%, to 11-12, and again another decline into this coming financial year of another 7%. Now, with old infrastructure like our country, we surely cannot be seeing capital budgets go down. They'll need to go up. So, as I said, the data that we get is, in terms of the municipalities, what I see as the upper end for households to be able to access free basic is now ranging from 940 rand a month up to 1,800 or 900 a month and higher. And 88 municipalities fall outside of this scope. Now, those of us, I know some members work in housing, will know that now we are out of the housing basics. I think there is some scope to review the actual allocations in this kind. On the block tariffs, I'm not going to say too much because there's been so many people have explained what it is this morning, and I think that is quite clear. I think we just need to give a sense of the Treasury's concern in by and large with the block tariff is that it's not cost reflective. How it works with the infrastructure is the more you use, the lower the cost of the infrastructure. And if we are going to start charging people, those whose costs are lower, we are going to start charging more. And that can be quite problematic if we need to ensure that there's a cost-reflective tariff, because this is a user charge apart from the surcharge, which I might just want to say one or two things about. People have said the prepaid meter cannot currently, there'll have to be some investment on the actual metering. And then in terms of the municipalities, when there's not a cost-effective tariff, when they don't have very high-income households or users, we start running into problems that there are no households to cross-subsidize, and then we have a problem. And also, I I really think that the ESCOM proposal to look at the block tariffs from a technology perspective, so that you take the 20, 40, 60 volt and you put the price on those, is possibly the quickest way to solve a problem, and it might be quite easy to implement. So I do think the department can take that issue forward. So I'm not going to go into the detail. I mean, as I say, our concern is that it's, at this stage, this thing is not cost reflective. The policy currently on the table for electricity pricing says we must have a cost reflective tariff. So that is something that I'm glad people are saying that we need to start addressing. I did write quite a lot about the block tariffs, actually. but I'm not going to go into detail. I did want to add something else on these surcharges. There were some concerns raised during the morning's discussion that NASA is not regulating the surcharges. The National Treasury has a piece of legislation called the Municipal Fiscal Powers and Functions Act. And that act allows for the surcharges to be introduced, and it provides for the Treasury to put down regulations to guide the surcharges on municipal services. We are pushing quite hard from public finance to get those surcharges, the regulations done. Possibly within the next year or two, we can come back to at least put some guidance down in terms of what levels of surcharges are viable. I think from where we're sitting in terms of the delivery side on public finance is a surcharge should be put on the cost of a service after you have operated and maintained that service. So the additional money should go over maintenance. What we see now is people are charging a rate, they don't do the maintenance, so now the surcharge becomes everything. And that's something we can't afford that to happen. And then, Chair, maybe just my last comment. I think the FSC has given a good overview of why this is an equitable share payment and not a conditional grant. I think that is a sort of practical way to go about it. And it also puts us in line with the Constitution that makes this a municipal function. And, you know, we wonder if everybody can agree that this is so important, how can the money not go but that must remain an accountability of local government. Thank you, Jay.
Thank you very much, Marisa. Honourable members, I know we've been forced to absorb a lot, and we still have ESCOM coming thereafter. Can I plead? Let's focus on the questions. I trust and hope you have taken copious notes. I really would like us to really zoom into questions for clarity now, as much as we can. From SALCA, Treasury, and ESCOM, definitely. Over to you. Teres Lau, Matibel, and the Lucas, Honorable Smala Ross, and the Honorable Bowman will be the last.
So, although I'll go by your guidance now, it must still be remembered that I reserved my questions in the morning on DOE, on the basis that the presentation must be supported by the rest of the other presentations.
You can shoot off now.
Yeah. But at the moment, let me get into Treasury. My little knowledge of how we deal with budgets at Parliament level, and I want to check the difference between budgeting at this level and budgeting at local government level, is that the executive comes to us and say, we want so many billions of rand, and this billions that we want, we break it down according to this and that and administration, this and that, this and that, this and that, this and that. And then, of course, we give that money. we expect that money to be spent according to how it has been requested. Now, it looks like, and I want clarity on that, that the same does not apply to local government. In local government, is that this is your equitable share, and then this one is conditional. Now, that equitable will be decided by the particular municipality as to where to use it and how to go about with their own environment from time to time. Resultantly, that they end up not having to use it in accordance with their priorities out of the IDP. I just want to get clarity around that particular area of equitable and conditional as undermining the issues of programs and projects. The other question I would wish to put to NERSA is that the question of block tariffs is completely getting discouraged from one corner to the other. And the study that has been made by NERSA does not seem to enjoy second opinion. All other opinions are saying, re-look at that particular issue. It does not, your calculations and your plan does not seem to address the challenges we have at hand. What is your take around that particular matter? And on Eskom, there are three areas actually I want to touch there. The issue of the lack of rural infrastructure, the issue of the inconsistent identification of indigent or poorest of the poor, and the issues of farm workers' access to electricity. These three areas are seemingly serious challenges that are saying to us, we are not about to reach those people with free basic electricity. What is work in progress in regards to those particular issues? Where are we? Are we just saying, here they are, there are problems, we leave them to you? Where do we go around those particular issues? I think, Chair, with the limitations that you gave, I will go that far.
Thank you, Chairperson. To Salga, I've got a problem and a concern at the same time. That government has put down a lot of structures. We've got the ward committees. Those ward committees, whether it's rural or it's urban, it's their duty to go about and look for the poor people, the ones who qualify for the free basic electricity. But here it seems to me nothing of that sort is happening in the municipalities. I just wanted to know why. And the other thing is, it's also like the data. Because those ward committees are the ones who are collecting data. They are the ones who are bringing the numbers and the homes of the poor people who are supposed to get those free basic electricity. It doesn't augur well with me unless municipalities are doing something different, which other municipalities, or which is not in line with their work. Otherwise, then I think the ward committees are not supposed to be there. If they can't do that, then the ward committees are absolutely useless, because they've got a stipend which they get for the work that they are doing. They are the ones who are our eyes and ears down there. Thank you, Chairperson.
Yes, thanks, Chair.
I see the statement about historically and the pricing. It gives me great concern because I don't understand it really, because I think we feel as though we're being bled when we pay. The issue that worries, really concerns me also, is the Systems Act, the principle for tariff setting, and municipalities not following it. I mean, that's a disaster. I mean, they can't blame the people if the municipality is not setting the prices and following the Systems Act, because then it is wrong. You can't buy electricity for, instance, 100 rand and sell it for 95 rand. It's a dead loss straight away. And the other disaster is the maintenance of the system. If you do not maintain it, it's going to cost you money. So all these things should be built in. And it is really worrying that we don't carry this out. And I do know that municipalities, the profit they make from electricity is always diverted to other issues. And this is what is the crux of the problem. If it was a ring fence for electricity, I think we'd go much further.
Thank you, Chair. Just to add to my colleague speaking about ring fencing, I think I'm well aware that there should be a separate books for electricity at local government level. I think it's prescribed in the Systems Act, where they need to do their planning and accountability on specific electricity income and reticulation and all that. And I wonder if NERSA is playing the role that they should be playing in, to see that there's compliance in this regard. And perhaps NERSA can just give us a guidance on that as well. But then just from NERSA, let me just take it to the following step in monitoring compliance. If it does not happen, there are specific regulations that NERSA can follow, even expropriation of the license. We've never seen any discipline brought into the system. Perhaps we have all the right legislation, perhaps everything is in place, but there's no compliance and everybody's looking at each other. It's unfortunate that COPCA is not present, because that brings me to the next item that I'd like to discuss, and that's the debt to municipalities of 62.3 billion. It is absolutely unacceptable. I've never seen such an amount of 63 billion. It could have funded our whole capital expenditure program and more if only we could get to some sort of correction. And that's the point. At local level, and that's unfortunately in the absence of COPCA that I have to say, there's simply no commitment to collect revenue at all. If they collect it, it's a bonus. If they don't, they are totally dependent on national government in terms of the grants. And we've been told today that money is perhaps not the problem, but it's in the budgeting process that happens, how they budget and the priorities that they give to spending these money. The mismanagement of finances at that level is just terrific, and I think I'd like to make the point that it's totally unacceptable. And the corruption levels certainly reflects on the Auditor General's reports. COPCA needs to be responsible even to this committee in terms of how they manage the electricity reticulation set of books, and we can go into every municipality and see if there's some accountability in terms of what they spend on infrastructure or not, because there's always and always has been some prescriptions how much they must spend on infrastructure. And then once again that brings us back to the role of NERSA. What is NERSA doing regarding this? Are they doing enough, or are they folding their hands, or are we sitting with the old problem that this is a separate entity of government, that there's a constitutional conflict? And just to, coming to that, ma'am, I did not say that NERSA are currently not regulating the surcharges. It's in the new act that I said, the new era act, that in that conflict of interest, that the definition of tariffs is being removed and in favor of municipalities, that will have then no oversight by NERSA. Currently, NERSA has the obligation to have the oversight on the municipalities. And perhaps as an
tenant...
And then my question in regard to this is the Treasury guidelines that you spoke about. I'm very relieved to hear the Treasury is involved, that they give guidelines. When will we see that guidelines, and how does that guideline fit into the proposed new legislation in terms of this? And then a last comment, Chair, with permission, and then I will not ask any question again today. or make a remark. The historically underpricing of electricity. I'm not sure if electricity was ever so cheap for everybody in this country. What was very cheap is the special prices to that bigger intensity users in terms of Billiton and Anglo-American and the special pricing arrangements that were made by contract. But my information is that electricity for the ordinary consumer in the country was always more or less in terms of international best practice. What we see now with the reduction, and I'm sorry, I can give you that full explanation afterwards, what we've seen with the reduction of 10% is that municipalities will at least have a little bit less implementation because the bigger industries, it's cheaper to supply electricity to them. They will pay, say, 17%, where the municipality's implementation is about 11%. But the perception of people always saying we had cheap electricity for so many years, it's only applicable to a certain portion of section. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. I think it sometimes comes to implementation and there are ways and means that we can do things in a quick way through regulations which the minister puts through and to adjust certain issues. And then, of course, the long term is when we go through the acts. And when we look at the backlog of the maintenance infrastructure and the reducement of capital investment, it has actually come time that we've got to force percentages to budget, to allocations of electricity. We sit presently also with a situation where 553 million rand has not been paid over by local authorities to municipalities. And this is also another concern, because how should Eskom then fund their own projects if government itself fails in its obligations to some of these entities? And this is this is also a serious concern for me, where COPTAG comes and it's we are pushing, we're not taking responsibility, or we're not willing to take action or to take away licenses when entities fail. My question is also around the equitable share is, have we got proper checks and balances in place to say if Treasury allows for funding for X thousand indigenous members to apply for those benefits, does it actually go out to those people, or is it just another movement within the operational budget, which the poor of the poor actually doesn't benefit? The municipality has actually applied for 100,000 or 500,000 or X amount of people, but doesn't actually go down because it comes back down to the Treasury's figures, what we saw today, and what the figures is what we saw from the department. And those are the discrepancies which we need to start talking to each other and not try to hide behind just for the sake to look good, because I think that is what is actually happening. The billing of the block tariffs, earlier I think it was the department said that the first they will the second block starts again at the first block of the payment. And there was a price schedule by Eskom with their different blocking system. What is the extent to what we are actually losing because of selling electricity then, where we should be starting at the next block, but we reverting back to that? What is the actual financial implication to government due to non-compliance or due to not understanding the correct procedures? Because we've got to start putting figures to it, because that's what actually comes towards what affects the our tax base. Is NERSA happy with the proposed tariff structure by Eskom, the 3
tariff that has been given to us in order to maybe lead to less discriminations to consumers. I need you to understand that, because we need to come to a place where we start discriminating less against any type of consumers. Let me stop there, Chair. I know your time is limited there.
I want to just perhaps start with a question on slide 14 to Treasury. I just want to understand this slide a little bit better. It seems to add up your municipalities coming downwards, and I'm not adding up across, and I'm just wondering, you know, if this is supposed to be saying something else. So I'm not quite understanding what this is about. And then Eskom, I want to refer to a couple of things. In your envisaged solutions, you talk about municipalities to update their indigent registers annually and confirm correctness. And then when you come to your conclusions, you pick this up again. And for me, you talk about lack of properly administered indigent registers. This thing with indigent registers really worries me. And we've seen here today the discrepancies, and everybody's now presented, so we've got the full picture. And for me, and I say this again, we cannot get, and we're talking about free basic electricity here, if we don't know what's on our database as an indigent, how can we possibly deal with this? So I need to say, when we say that there's a lack of these things, how far are we? And I say this perhaps to Eskom, to Selga, and I think Selga must take a lot more responsibility for what's happening at local government level. We've had, since 2000, this sphere of government now stands, you know, fully on its own, and I think we do need to see a little bit more of the responsibility being taken for things that are going wrong there. Then, because this leads me to another bullet point in Eskom's thing, where you say attention should be given on extending free basic electricity to indigent households not yet receiving free basic electricity, rather than extending the FBE. Now, my question there would be, and again we talk about this database and the register, if we don't know, how do we know, and who are we extending it to? That's what I'd like to know, because it just doesn't make sense to me. And then I think, because the chairperson is really anxious, perhaps. If I may also, I just want to pick up also on slide 7 with Eskom, where you talk about the quarterly meetings. And you mentioned Eskom, COPTA, NERSA, DPE, DOE, and SALGA. And I'm just wondering if human settlements oughtn't to be there as well. And I know perhaps it's the whole jolly lot, but anyway, I think they need to be there. Thanks.
We're going to let you answer.
I think the first is the most difficult question. Obviously, I think the big difference is the certainty on revenue, where when we come and budget here, we know how much money we're going to collect. And obviously, at the national sphere, there are responsibilities if we underestimate that loss comes to national. With municipalities, there's not so many places to share a loss if you overestimate your revenue source. You know, you can't pass it on. You can't say the big brother must look after the loss. And it does seem as so. I think that's the first problem: is what are you budgeting with? How thick is your purse when you start? And as I said, what municipalities tend to do is they tend to project that they're going to collect much more revenue, and they tend to project that they're going to spend much less money. So the costing of the service in terms of the operational cost and the maintenance cost is not properly done, which shouldn't be that difficult. I mean, we should be able to support that function. And then the estimate of how much money is going to come in. So you start off with what we call an unrealistic budget. That budget is put in place and everybody seems happy that they're doing the right thing at a council level, the council approves a environment policy that they must say how much money can you shift like we do between functions or away from capital, etc. So that's largely a council responsibility to say how much of that budget can then shift. And then unfortunately the other area is the ability to spend that money. Because then what we see is on the capital side mostly, you find that even if you put this money down and you didn't shift it away, you weren't able to spend that money because of constraints on capacity, technical skills, etc. So I think those are the large things. It's unrealistic to start with. And then we are not quite able to spend it where it's supposed to be spent. And I think that does lead to money going to areas that are not critical to service delivery. Obviously, when it's a conditional grant, there are a very clear framework on what you can spend the money on. The outputs and the outcomes are defined and the conditions on which you can spend it, and there's a reporting framework on which you might put a report. If you do not spend the money, you have to revert it back to the National Revenue Fund. Treasury goes as far as deducting money from the equitable share if I keep that money and haven't spent it properly. So we do keep a very tight ship to ensure that that happens. But, I mean, as was indicated, this is a basic service that municipalities must provide, and they must have the will to deliver it, And we have, you can see just on the big numbers that the more we give, the less comes from that side. And that's what can happen. I think FSC mentioned that if you start putting this thing as a conditional grant, there will be less responsibility for it and less accountability for it, as opposed to what we want, in which is more accountability. Maybe I can get to the honourable member also, raise this issue around the checks and the balances, and I think it relates to that. The Treasury, we do not monitor performance for equitable share because it is a local government responsibility to decide how they spend it, on what they spend it, how much they spend it on. As long as that is, as they can be accountable in terms of their mandates to their own constituencies. And I do think that is why some of the frustration of the numbers is coming out, because there is not a direct reporting back to the Treasury. DOE, I don't think you get a direct reporting back on indigent registers. It's largely become a cooperative governance function to put down the policy of how local government does that. And it speaks to that level of accountability. There is no formal reporting outside of the municipal feedback. I hear the historical understanding, and I understand what you guys are saying. And it's true. It must be. I don't want to debate that. I think the issue here is that the prices in general in this country wasn't cost-reflective of what we needed to invest, and we were caught with, if I can be rude, chair, with our pants down. The reinvesting matter, there are actually a couple of ways to do this, and one is, as has been called for by NARSA saying that we will, that they must ensure that there's proper reporting in terms of collections and spending when municipalities ask for a tariff. But the Treasury, in our accounting standards and the standard charts of accounts, are also putting in guidelines for municipalities so that they report on the collections and the revenue in a separate line. So I think from our combined efforts, we will see improvements of municipalities in this thing, but it is never we can put regulations down, but it's going to take a couple of years for that to happen. When we started this at provincial level, it took 5 years, and we started it at local, it's going to take some time, but at least I think, you know, they are both at the regulator and at the treasury side, we are trying to do exactly that, to improve the clarity on terms of what's being spent and what's being collected. I can just agree with the concerns raised around the debt. It is a problem. As I indicated, the regulations regarding the surcharges, we are hoping to finalise, if not this year, then next year. It can have quite an impact on the municipalities, so you're going to literally have to go through all those budgets and understand the impact of any guidance that we put down in terms of the ability or... Because the ability to put a surcharge down is a constitutional right, as far as I understand. It is just to be a bit clearer in terms of the relationship that the Treasury will come in, and we must be sure that we don't negatively impact on municipalities. The first part of the budget is in our... This is where the independence of local government is independent.
30 seconds more.
Yes. I think there can be guidelines. I think NERSA can put out guidelines in terms of what they think should be spent. I actually think NERSA has put out guidelines to say how much is. But the first thing, why are they independent if the other people can force them to do things? It is difficult, but I do think accountability at local level is what needs. If you can educate people, then they can maybe take it forward. There's 45 municipalities that doesn't add up across the line. I suspect we either don't have information for them or they don't report on the thematic approach. So it speaks to the information flow issue again on that indigenous policy. Thank you, Chair.
The rest of the team, you're lucky you're going to get off the hook. Well, one hook, you and 10 help us be on this. You just have to fly through. One of the members, please, if there's nothing, if some of the questions have not been properly answered, just make sure that Mr. Arikoko collects all those points and will ensure that whether it's NERSA, ESCOM, or the department, or FFC, or SALCA, they respond in writing. No question will not be answered, whether verbal or in writing. But we can't go beyond that possibility because we still have two presentations, very lengthy presentations, too. ESCOM?
Thank you, Chair. Perhaps what I can do is, in terms of the first three questions around progress we've done on rural infrastructure, the farm workers and inconsistent identification of indigenous, I'll group it with the questions from the Honourable Ms. Bowman as well, because they are related. I think the important thing to highlight is that in 2009, COPTA facilitated a workshop there between municipalities and ESCOM, where the objective of that workshop was to share information around the challenges with regards to FBE and specific actions that could come out of there. And Chair, I need to be blatantly honest and say that from that workshop, unfortunately, not much has happened since then, because one of the decisions was that these things would actually be monitored through regional energy forums, where the municipalities would call upon those forums and discussions would take place. And that's what I have in the envisaged solutions, are really the actions that should have taken place. And also with a change in leadership in COCTA, and unfortunately they're not here today, the intention was that COCTA would on an ongoing basis get us all together and make sure that these things are actually operationalized. And unfortunately that hasn't happened. What we have done on our side as ESCOM, identifying that and recognizing that this is a key area for the country. During our strategy review, we actually started looking at some of the options that could be looked at in terms of improvement of SPE, and which is why we actually have said that the focus for us would have been trying to identify as many people that do qualify first before we actually can think about increasing the level of SPE itself. And in terms of, for example, farm workers, it was very clear to us that there's a large part of the population that is left out in terms of this. And what was important is how do we then make sure that the farm workers who actually have their dwellings in the farmer's land also do benefit from it, because, you know, they would also qualify. And we came up with a number of various options. Chair, we have really done a business case around that, and we can make the presentation available to the committee. I would prefer not to go into the details of that in the interest of time, because these options also have pros and cons that needs to be taken into account, and the municipalities would have to say what is it that they are comfortable with in terms of that. We didn't want to impose any specific options on the municipalities. So the envisaged solutions are really what was workshopped between ourselves and the municipalities, and said what is it that we need to do on our side as ESCOM, what do the municipalities need to do for us to be able to turn things around in this program. And I think, Chair, we take your point that in terms of the quarterly meetings is what ESCOM is suggesting, and that probably human settlement as well should be a part of that. I think on the issue of electricity pricing, I'll give Kanan Lakmiharan a chance to respond on that.
Chair, very quickly as well, I think it's important to note that ESCOM is busy renegotiating the special pricing agreements. We have concluded two, there are two left. But it's also important to note that historically, up till 2007-08, these agreements actually cross-subsidized other users. That means we were gaining more revenue than it cost for those agreements, and it only turned around in 2007-08. And that cannot be allowed to continue. But up to 2007-08, these companies were cross-subsidizing other users. So that's also an important fact to also put on the record.
Chair, thank you very much for the comments. As Aula, we know the comments and the inputs, and then we will work with all the stakeholders to resolve some of the suggestions, especially with regard to the indigenous registers. And all the other questions, Chair, we will reply to the right. Thank you.
Yes, Chair. Thank you. The question that we asked for I think it's about IBTU. The concerns that people have on IBTs. We are aware of that, Chair, and we have reopened this debate by issuing this discussion paper. We are in the middle of going through that discussion paper, and we will be finalizing this matter and taking into consideration the recommendations that we have from ESCOM. I do believe that they responded to the discussion paper. So when we finalize that, we'll take into consideration all the inputs that we're going to get from the people. In terms of the ring fencing, I think the National Treasury has answered that very well. We've got reporting manuals for the MUNICs that we are proposing. Those reporting manuals, they require that they ring fence all the things that they do. So we're in the middle of doing that with the help of the National Treasury Chair. In terms of compliance monitoring, we do compliance monitoring, Chair, a lot. But when you look at the Act, the worst we can do to MUNICs is that we should penalize them, and the penalty is monetary in nature. It can go up to 2 million rand a day for any offense that we found that they are committing. Now, looking at the fact that the MUNICs don't have money and everything, I don't think that that penalty really will be effective. Hence, we are really trying to work with them to make sure that they comply by making sure that they do all of these things that they have to do, working with National Treasury, of course, and all the other stakeholders. Thank you, Chair.
Honourable Member, since I must thank everyone. It's been a brilliant thing. And shall I say we did more than we could do for the day. imagine if COCTA was here. Without having consulted people, can I just throw something on the table? Why don't we have a rejoinder on this through public hearing? You know, I made a note of a lot of things here, and I realized that very little justice has been done to each of these. From what the Honorable Sla was saying, the problem statement arrangement, you know. The basic thing for us here was for us to understand free basic electricity and free basic alternative energy, which nobody has touched, which is good in any case. Imagine if we could have involved it, you know. Good that people sidestepped it, but we must put on record. You were very crafty in your footwork on the boxing ring to sidestep the free basic alternative energy. Fine. We tried our best to focus, but every time broader issues kept on popping up. Even if members, I was trying to suppress you. But still, it's obvious you couldn't avoid that the focus on free basic electricity cannot, be dealt with in a justifiable way without linking it to a couple of broader issues. Policy, governance, basic services, not just basic electricity, but basic services and the likes. But I can't but not comment that sharing information through regional energy forums, there's ICT once again. To me, energy forums, even if they were regular, they should actually be benchmarks or landmarks of information that flows in through software. Please. We will not be ICT fundies, but let's not wait until people drive 30 minutes, an hour to go to a meeting before we share information. If I can plead with you that, I don't even want to read this because I had a full list to show why I'm motivating, but we will work with all the institutions and agencies that were here today, including COCTA as well, and try to see what's the best timing to go into this once again to ensure that we exhaustively handle all of this. I mean, our work is not just to conduct oversight, but also to facilitate public participation and influence other things. And obviously in public hearings, you know, your S-Life and even other civil society organizations or even experts for that matter who have interest or are directly involved in this would have to be invited in that respect. Thank you very much. Can you move to ESCOM now? Or DOE, you are not off the hook. One of the soft points and the sensitive issues. Thank you very much to everybody. Thank you very much. One of the key issues that has been coming up raised in the media, at times appropriately, and at times being abused as a political football, sensationalized, is the interruption of supply of electricity. And this committee felt that we need to get a good update and briefing from ESCOM, in particular, as the key driver of this. But logically, the department will always have to pave the way and get from them. Or if we are Sahala, over 300.
Thank you, Chairperson. My presentation is from a policy perspective in terms of the strategy that we have adopted in the short to medium term to address the envisaged difference between supply on one side and demand on the other side. And Chair, in order for me to achieve that, I thought I would touch on these agenda items. Chair, essentially, the content is showing three main bullets. The first two, Chair, if you like, is on the production of electricity and demand thereof. And then the third bullet, Chair, which I thought is also important, is to touch a bit on the distribution side of things. more so we all aware that there's a problem with the maintenance of the grid site. So, Chair, my presentation is split into two, supply on one side and the grid on the other side. Now, before I get into an overview, a policy overview, I thought perhaps to touch a little bit on the value chain that I'm referring to. The focus of this presentation, Chair, is on the generation side of electricity on one side, as well as on the distribution side of electricity. What I'm showing there is some key statistics, but I'm sure members are aware of what is happening in that regard. We have about 182 municipalities that are licensed to reticulate electricity, and parallel to that, we have some areas that are serviced by Eskom. So if you like, we can say we have 182 plus one distributors of electricity. On the generation side, it's predominantly our state-owned company, controlling about 97% and split across those technologies. So the focus on the presentation is on the red cycle as well as on the blue cycle. Insofar as the middle one is concerned, the transmission, we have had a proposal, a transmission planning proposal from Eskom, and you know, Chair, from that regard, things are not looking as if they're about to fall off. However, our concern is mainly on the generation and on the distribution side, and hence the presentation will only touch on those two. The brief background that I want to provide is that we currently have a 20-year policy document which we refer to as Integrated Resource Plan. However, for the purpose of this presentation, I'm only touching on the medium term of this 20-year plan, and that is from year 2010 up to 2016. And I'll explain the reason why only this particular year. Okay, in developing the 20-year policy plan, we did acknowledge that initially when we start implementing this policy document, there will be some urgent or immediate areas that we'll need to implement without necessarily going through the full process to implement the policy. And this is the shortfall that we are referring to, Chair, in this presentation. Chair, perhaps to give a bit of a further background, that we identified a shortfall in the medium term. However, there were certain key assumptions that we made, and those assumptions obviously led us to say between these periods we might have a problem in terms of meeting the demand from the available supply. And these four points, I'm highlighting the key assumptions that we made. Some of the assumptions have materialized, for example, the first one, that we made an assumption that the electricity demand will grow at a certain percentage, and that percentage is linked to the percentage for the economic growth. However, we are all aware that the economy has not grown as envisaged, so therefore that translates to a lower demand. So I will only touch on that one just for time's sake. Then in the medium term, we were focusing mainly on the projects that will be able to generate power between periods of 2010 and 2016. So within that 6-year period, that's the focus of the medium term. And our analysis, Chair, indicated that in 2012, to be specific, that's the peak of the difference between the supply and the demand, and that peak is stated as 1,000 megawatts. Okay, this is the summarized version of the 20-year plan. It just indicates to members what we intend to build for the next 20 years. The circle in orange or yellow is for the period 2010 up to 2016. Just to quickly orientate the members, in the first column here we have from year 2010 up to year 2030, so that's a 20-year period. And across the first row, we have all the different technologies. that we want to introduce to the mix. Currently, we have about 97%, which is largely coal-fired power stations. Chair, what is not included here is those projects that, at the time of developing this policy document, we had already committed to. And those are projects such as the current BUILD program, spearheaded by ESCOM, and that's the Ingula Kusile Medupi, as well as some other small-scale, medium-term projects that were introduced when we, so that were already in a commercial finalization stage when we developed the document. So what I'm indicating here is for the next 20 years, this is the new build, and these are the options that we have. So when you look carefully at this, you will see that the medium-term projects are not included in this, because that was a strategy to say this is a full 20-year plan. However, between now and 2016, we need to introduce a small suite of projects to meet the anticipated shortfall between supply and demand. When we developed this document in 2010, the darker green colors, that's when the decisions were supposed to be made within the same period. And then the light green, the decisions are due now, as indicated on the slide. So the characteristic of this project is that, you know, it takes anything between two years to 10 years from the moment you make a decision to start construction to the date wherein you are ready to connect to the grid and provide the power. So what that means is that you must make decisions upfront. You don't wait for 2014 and say, this year I need a wind turbine. You make that decision earlier, so that by 2014 you have that 400 megawatts of wind. So without laboring the slide, I will quickly touch on the medium-term mitigation plan, which is part and parcel of the integrated resource plan document. So we had two phases that were defined at the beginning, and that was in 2010. The phase one was the assessment of the situation in terms of the assumptions that we had made and taking into account certain key factors, such as if, for example, Medupi is scheduled to come online at this particular date, we assume that it would come online at that particular date. So if that variance changes, obviously it affects our analysis based on our assumptions. So based on those assumptions, we came up with a plan that you will see through my presentation, that in year 2012, that plan was saying that's the peak of the shortfall between your supply and your demand. And that peak was defined, at that time was defined as 1,000 megawatts. Chair, phase two was obviously the implementation of that plan, the plan that was coming from phase one. I'm not going to go through the small bullet points, just to demonstrate that we had an assessment, a planning, and an implementation. So currently, we are in the middle of the implementation of that medium-term plan. Chair, this is what I was indicating, that based on our assumptions and assessment, we identified year 2012. Here you have year 2011, 12, 13, up to 2017. Then across you have the megawatts that is the shortfall between what will be available and what will be demanded. As members can see, in year 2012, about 9 terawatt hours, which is translated to approximately 1,000 megawatts of base load, would be the shortfall. And we are in the middle of that chair this year. So I will talk to more to what is being done to address that. So in terms of our supply options, the programs that we have jointly, Department, Treasury, ESCOM, and public enterprise have introduced the following programs. So the first one is the Renewable Energy Independent Power Producer Program, which at that time, I think it was August of last year, we made an announcement that would procure 3,700 megawatts of clean, renewable IPP power. Chair, of this we have, in November of last year, we managed to shortlist about 28 bids that would total to 1,400 megawatts. We're expecting, Chair, that they would start construction in June of this year. Maybe while I'm still at this on this point, Chair, is that we have, on the 5th of March of this year, we have closed the second window. If you recall, our procurement for renewable energy was spread across 5 windows, with the megawatt being rolled over for each window. So on the 5th of March this year, we closed the second window. The teams are busy now assessing the response from the market. What we can disclose now is we received about 76 bids compared to the 53 bids that we received in window one. So, Chair, the indicator is that the interest in the market is picking momentum, and we're hoping, because of that, we're hoping to see more competition, especially on the pricing of these renewable energy. Chair, the second program that I thought I would include in this presentation is the Open Cycle Gas Turbine Project. This is a peaking plant in its nature, in that it only operates during certain hours of the day. So it doesn't run flat out throughout the day. It only runs in the mornings mostly, and in the evenings when we start our cooking. The 1,000 megawatts, and it's diesel-fired initially, with a strategy to convert it to gas. We're also expecting that by June of this year, they would start construction. Then 2013, 18 months thereafter, December 2013, they would be connecting the first megawatts on the grid. So over and above those, there's also discussions with certain key industries to look at the co-generation option. What co-generation means is that you get a commercial customer that generates steam, and they use steam for their own production of paper or sugar. But what happens is that that steam, currently they recycle as much as they can, but the rest they release to the atmosphere. So we are negotiating with them to take some of that steam and convert it to electricity, so that we can reduce, firstly they will reduce their own demand, and then secondly they will supply to the grid. That's on the supply side, Chairperson. And then on the demand side, there are two key. There's an energy efficiency one, which we refer to as energy conservation scheme. And then there's a second one, which is more on the demand side management, and that's the solar water heating program. The uptake on the solar water heaters is very, well, it's not as per our expectations, Chair. And we do recognize that there are certain shortfalls that we try to address by introducing it, what we refer to as the standard offer policy. The standard offer policy will essentially increase the, in our view, will increase the appetite in the market, wherein you expect service providers to install the geysers, and they will, over a period of time, get a payback from the local municipalities on those installed geysers. Okay, just to summarize all those programs on the supply side of things, as I indicated, the Renewable Energy IPP program, we're expecting that the first unit will connect to the grid in 2013, which is next year. About 1,400 megawatts have been shortlisted as preferred bidders, and the difference between that is about 2,300 megawatts, which we're hoping to procure over the 5-window period that you specified. The co-generation, the key industries that we are talking to is the sugar industry as well as the paper industry. On the sugar industry, we know that there's an issue between, that we mustn't make it more commercially okay for the sugar guys to lose focus on producing sugar and now become power producers. So it's a balance that we're trying to strike on those two, that, it's not power before food, is actually the other way around, that their primary business is to produce sugar, and then whatever gets left is used to produce electricity. And they indicated to us that they could have about 1,000 megawatts available by 2014. So that's the basis of the discussions with them. The open circle gas turbine, I've talked to the chair, the commercial operation is expected in 2013, which is also next year. Energy conservation scheme as well as the solar water heating from the demand side of things. There are certain rules that were relating to energy conservation scheme, Chairperson, that we had to consult with intensively, that other stakeholders were not happy on certain things. And we also had to make sure that by implementing these rules, we don't force industries to reduce production so that then, because that will result to, in some industries, loss of jobs if the production is less than what they used to. We're trying to introduce the right incentives for them to participate under energy conservation scheme. And one of those is the tax incentive scheme that we have been in discussions with National Treasury. Solar water heater, I've talked to that, and that's essentially the standard offer policy that we are introducing. Okay, to summarize on the supply side before I get to the grade side of issues, there are essentially three key programs on the supply side that I wanted to focus on. The renewable energy IPP, I've talked to that. Over and above that, because the renewable energy was focusing on certain technologies, and the department has received concerns from the market that they have this power available, but they don't know how to enter into the market because their technology is not listed there. So on the basis of that, we issued what we refer to as request for information, and this was only limited to these four technologies. Gas, coal, and on a smaller scale, imported hydro, as well as coal generation. We are closing the request for information chase for us to gather the market intelligence to understand what is available out there. And we're intending that the 26th of March will be the closing date for that, and then the department can then assess the responses. And based on that, we will design a suitable procurement program. Co-generation, as I indicated, we are in talks with certain industrial processing plants. Okay, on the grid side of things, now we have touched on the supply, and the supply was mainly targeted at how do we increase the production of electricity, so I've touched on that. On the grid side of things, Chair, it's more on the delivery of this increased production. About 2 weeks ago, Chair, we did indicate that we...
Do you really need to go through the grid part?
Okay, no, I'll take that action.
I had a look at it, and I just felt, because we've just recently handled it, and because of pressure of time, honorable members, you know, really, our interest is the power interruption. We know it has an influence, but at least we can recollect and make the linkage. Thanks very much for now. ESCOM?
Thank you, Chair. And thanks to honorable members for giving us the opportunity to present this to you. Firstly, apology from our Chief Executive, Mr. Damas. If you've been, and since you talked about ICT, Mr. Chair, if you follow Twitter, Minister Gaba was tweeting where he was talking about hosting the Chairman and Chief Executive of state-owned corporations in Pretoria today. And that's where Mr. Damas is. And one of their purposes was to sign a $49 million pledge, and a pledge that all state-owned corporations will, even if it's not mandatory, sign up to the energy conservation scheme and do their bit. So today was the signing of the chairman. All the chairmen had to sign their pledges, and it will be reported on a quarterly basis to the shareholder. So at least the state-owned corporations must take a lead. So I hope you had a good reason not to be here.
No, he told me. Fine.
Great.
Except one thing. We should all be taught how to teach. Some of us are Facebook friends.
Yes, sir. Chair, And following on the Department of Energy, we have worked closely with the Department of Energy in the last 2 years around this issue and the Department of Public Enterprises. And as our colleague said, we're especially concerned about the next 2 years, 2012, 2013, and it's going to be very tight. But this has been the situation since we had mandatory load shedding in 2008, and we've had a significant challenge balancing supply and demand. And part of the way we met this balance or kept things in balance was by shifting our maintenance where it was not critical. So we had to deal with critical maintenance that had to deal with safety or statutory issues. But other maintenance we had to balance against keeping the lights on. But we cannot keep doing that because we're dealing with assets that need to be maintained for long term. And we think we've reached the point where that cannot continue and is not sustainable. We are in summer, which is traditionally our maintenance period. And what we've been doing in Eskom over the last few months, since November last year, is running the system at a high level of risk to ensure we don't get into a further backlog around maintenance. But again, that does introduce some risk. We have seen, as our colleagues mentioned, that demand has been lower. But what we've seen, though, is in summer our peaks are higher, and that's because of affluence. We've seen more air conditioning load. So that's a new challenge. It's a different challenge we're facing. In the past, we saw winter loads being high because everyone had heaters and lights and so on, but now starting to see air conditioning. It is a sign of growing wealth, but it is a challenge. We've also had, and partly due to the lack of maintenance at some of our stations, increased unreliability, and it's important that we don't let that continue. We also have imports from Cahora Bassa, Mozambique, and we've seen some level of unreliability because they haven't been able to do the same work we did 2 years ago on our side. We refurbished some plant in near Pretoria, Tshwane. But at Songo, which is in near Cahora Bassa Dam, they haven't been able to do the same, and they need to spend some money doing that soon. But they haven't had the opportunity. We've also had to use our open-cycle gas turbines, which are very expensive down in the Cape, to help balance supply and demand, and that has other challenges around fuel logistics and also on the tariff. So that's the summary of where we are. This is a slide. I think it came out a bit difficult on the slide, but it's the same slide our colleagues put up around the challenge over the next 5 years, around the focus for supply and demand. But let me just summarize what we've done since the beginning of 2011 when, as Eskom, we started to come out around this challenge. My colleague from DOE mentioned 2011-12, we were worried that the problem would start. And we started at Eskom on a quarterly basis, presenting to media and to our stakeholders what we were doing, and we kept updating the country. One of the first things we said we had to do was improve our coal quality. We've made some significant step changes there, especially at one of our power stations, Duva. But we still have concerns at three stations, at Matla, Tutuka, and Arnott power stations, where we still have work to do to find a sustainable solution. We had to improve our generation performance by 1 to 2%, but we've had some setbacks there. The one that's reported in the media has been our Duva Unit 4, where we had a catastrophic failure. So that has set us back. In terms of signing up IPPs in the short term, while the Department of Energy was doing the longer-term procurement, we've exceeded our targets. We signed up from medium-term power purchase program 373 megawatts, of which 320 are operational. We went to our municipal colleagues and signed up 515 megawatts of generation that had stopped, 270 of which is operational on a reliable basis. And then in December, we went out to the market to say, can we sign up IPPs that are not generating on a short-term basis, and we've now done 120 megawatts. So the combined total in terms of contractual value is just over 1,000 megawatts, of which nearly 700 megawatts is now operational. We've done a lot more maintenance than we've ever done in our recent history. In December, for example, the average was just over 15%. In January and February, about 12%. But we still have to do a lot more to catch up. But it has, in the last 4 months especially, we've done a significant amount. We've done a lot of demand-side initiatives. In terms of our demand-side management program, we've saved 347 gigawatt-hours in this financial year. Our target is to reach 1,000 gigawatt-hours, just over that, by March, and we're hoping to do that. We have always in the past worked with our large customers to ask them to provide power over the period, essentially reduce the demand over peak as an incentive scheme. We are now extending that to smaller customers, and this is what is called a demand response aggregator, as it's cheaper to do that than to run the gas turbines, and it doesn't affect production or customer issues or customer requirements. We wrote that pilot. It started in December. We aim to get 500 megawatts by July, and we've already seen some success in that as well. As a temporary measure for these, for this maintenance period, because of the concerns we had, we've also had a power buyback program with some of our large customers where, based on the current economic situation, without affecting jobs and without affecting their contracts, we said, what can we do to buy back power? And we got 827 megawatts through that process. And that has helped us in the last few months, and we've got contracts till the end of May. And we spent a lot of time in the last 3 months consulting with many stakeholders and sharing the situation. On a quarterly basis, we always say what we think the situation will be in the power system, and you see that in this graph, what we said in November it would be. You'll see our planned status. And what you should see in terms of actual is that the actual situation has been a bit worse than our planned for two reasons. One is we've had worse than planned system performance, but in some cases we've also pushed more maintenance. And what we've seen, especially where you see the red, is we've had to use a lot of our gas turbines in that period. So we've had higher amount of gas turbine usage. And I've gone through some of the reasons why we've had those challenges. This graph shows you our plant performance, and the red line is what we'd like to target, 3,600 megawatts of unplanned outages. And you'll see periods where it has been above that. Sometimes it's, and the yellow is what we call partial losses. That's where we have a unit online, but not all of, we're not reaching full production. And part of our challenge is some of our units, like in Matimba Power Station, Majuba, Khrutfle, have dry-cooled power stations, and when there's excessive heat or the wind is in the wrong direction, we can't get as much power out of them. We've had up to 1,000 megawatts losses. And also, we've had coal quality problems at least, like I mentioned, three or four stations. And that has resulted in those partial load losses, and we have to deal with that. We are, though, in a very different space to 2008 when we had rotational load shedding. There are lessons that we have learned. The first one is to be more transparent about the system status, to be better prepared and to have better communication. We have that in place. Our customers get updates, and our large customers get updates twice on a day. So they are aware of the situation. Our coal stockpiles are now over 40 days, where in 2008 they were just under 13. We have much tighter coordination between our system operator that has to manage the grid and our generation division that has to do maintenance to ensure we can balance keeping the lights on versus maintenance. And we have better visibility within our management team and within government around what's going on. And if things do go wrong, we are able to contain it to a few hours rather than have its impact over large periods of time. But even those few hours, people will feel it, so we don't want to do that. What has happened since 2008? On the supply side, there's been 2,500 megawatts of new capacity added, some of it gas turbines as well as return to service stations in Eskom. We've signed up just over 1,000 megawatts from IPP programs, as we said. And there's more coming, as our colleague from DOE mentioned. Our coal stockpiles have improved, but we've also bought or rented a diesel storage facility because we're using our gas turbines more often. In the Cape, we have to truck our diesel to Ankele, so we needed to have some kind of buffer, and we've hired that buffer. While in Khirikwa, which is near Petro SA, we have at least they've got storage facilities for us. On the demand side, we have 1,600 megawatts of verified demand side savings through projects. And within our large customers, we've invested in 177 projects to help them become more efficient. So we've reinvested in our customers. We've developed various protocols to deal with emergencies, and we have tested them during the World Cup and COP17. And in COP17, for example, we worked very closely with the province of KwaZulu-Natal and the municipalities to do that, and they have worked. We've launched a power-led campaigns on SABC and ETV, and we've just extended it to DSTV. For those who watch DSTV, you'll see, have seen it. We have the 49 million campaign, and we've just launched a 5 to 9 campaign, which is about what can you do practically between 5 p.m. and 9 p.m. to help conserve. And you'll shortly see that on billboards and on TV as well. So to give practical tips to our consumers. What is this maintenance challenge that Eskom has been talking about? And I just want to take you through some of that. What you see on the graphs are a winter and summer profile, the winter in blue, the summer in the dashed brown. And what you'll notice is that during summer, we have to take the demand up after 5 o'clock and keep it there and then meet a short peak in the evening. So we have to keep a lot of our capacity available to and keep it online and then meet the short peak. In the past, we used to have more variation, but with air conditioning load now during the day, you see a very flat profile. In winter, you see those two peaks, and we have to keep our capacity on to meet that peak in the evening. And you'll see we have to ramp up nearly 5,000 megawatts to get there. So we have to keep 5,000 megawatts available just to meet that 1-2 hours in the evening. So those are some of the challenges we're facing during winter and summer. We are definitely seeing that if it gets colder, every degree centigrade above a certain average, the demand goes up 600 to 700 megawatts. And as I mentioned, in summer now, if it's a warmer than expected summer, it can go up 400 megawatts. So those are some of the changes we've seen in the last few years. Ideally, as a prudent asset manager, you want to do your maintenance on a preventative basis. You've heard from Treasury that it sometimes costs more to fix rather than to maintain. We want to maintain for safety, environmental, and asset health reasons. And we've just provided for your information the standard maintenance profiles. Just like taking your car, you want to take it in for services every 15,000 kilometers and you do different things. It's the same thing with our generation fleet. And we ideally need to do that. The other point that I wanted to mention is when you reach the midlife of a plant, you need to change certain big components. And one of them is called main steam pipework. It carries high pressure steam and pipework from our turbine to from our boilers to our turbine. And that is a safety issue. If that bursts, it can create damage to plant, but more importantly, it can kill if we don't manage that. So for us, that is a critical item we have to now maintain as we approach midlife. And those outages take a long time, nearly 3 months per unit. This is a maintenance we need to fit in while we go through midlife. This diagram then gives you a sense of how tight we're running the system and where our backlog is in maintenance. If you look at the graph, we ideally want to be to the right, if you look at it, of the red line. If you're to the left, you start using your emergency reserves and you are more at risk of load shedding. On the right, you're operating in a safer space. And you can see the blue, which is 2009, we're generally operating in the safer space. And then as we went to 2011, which is the green, there is more risk being taken. And ideally, you want to shift it back to the right. You'll see at the graph in the bottom how many of our stations are approaching their midlife, and I mentioned the maintenance requirements. And ideally, we need to do about 10% maintenance at this stage. And you can see for the last 4 years, we haven't been able to do that. We've been averaging 8.8 to 9.5. And our backlog in the middle of last year was sitting at 36 units. That means 36 units have not had the appropriate maintenance done ideally, and we've had to compromise. What we've done since we announced that is that we have been able to make some progress. Our backlog now sits around 25, and that is what we have to deal with in the next year and a half and catch up on that. And this graph gives you another view of the challenge we face. Once you take into account the demand and the necessity to provide additional appropriate reserves to manage the system, you have that yellow line which tells you how much maintenance you can do without taking into account our gas turbines, and the red line then adds back the KS turbines. And you'll see the blue, which is the amount of maintenance we need to do. And ideally, that blue should be under the yellow and at worst under the red. And you can see we cannot fit all the maintenance we need to do under that red line. So it's just a different way of looking at it. So we have a few choices. We either do the maintenance and then put the system at risk, or we try to shift that maintenance to other periods. But in order to do that, we need to do proper risk assessments to make sure we don't create damage to plant or safety issues. And we do that on an ongoing basis. This is a picture we did in January. We have managed to do some shifting, but it's still fairly tight, as I'll show you. So what is the state of our power system? Well, firstly, demand has been below expectations, and my colleague from DOE mentioned it. But as I mentioned, we have seen higher than expected summer peaks. And you'll see that we've given you various demand profiles for the last 4 years. We've been using our gas turbines much more. You'll see in 2011, November and December, the blue bars where the gas turbine use peaks, and in January where we've had high gas turbine usage. And even as we use these gas turbines quite a lot, we still have this maintenance backlog. When we did our planning in January, you'll see that ideally, without going into the detail, based on various scenarios around how our plant performs, we've presented the weekly status till July. And ideally, in planning mode, you want the situation to be in the green. And you can see there are various weeks that are the yellow and then orange, like in March, and in red in April and May. And we need to shift that back to yellow or green. Now, we've been able to do some of that by shifting some of the maintenance and getting levers, but this was what was the picture when we started in January, when we were talking to all our stakeholders. So based on that, we said, what is needed in the short term? Our colleagues from DOE talked about the medium term. What do we need to do in the next year to two? Immediately, we needed to find 1,000 megawatts as what we call base load and 2,000 megawatts over peak. And by July, we had to shift that around to give certainty to maintenance planning and to ensure we had a stable power system. So these are the targets that we started talking about in January that we had to get on to bring more certainty to the power system. Well, Eskom set up a recovery team internally to try to secure all these levers to make sure that we step up communications around energy efficiency, we are clear about the way we do maintenance, and whenever we get the space, do it quickly and efficiently, and make sure that we create a more sustainable maintenance philosophy. Our shareholder has been very supportive and has set up a task team involving ourselves and has involved Department of Energy and COCTA to look at how to coordinate the activities that will need government interventions and make sure that there's alignment around communication and update for cabinet. And that team has been working for a while now. What if you achieve those targets of 1,000 or 2,000 megawatts or even up to 3,000, you can start seeing the picture shifting to the green. And that's what we want to get it to. Where you see orange or red, then you've got to say, can you reprioritize that maintenance? So this picture gives you the mitigation if you can get those levers in place. So what have we done? We have, since we did that planning picture, we have signed up power purchase agreements with two municipalities, Johannesburg and Tshwane. As I said, we signed up short-term basis, whatever IPP capacity is available. We have signed power buyback agreements for until end of May. There are also some customers, and I must thank them, who have volunteered over peak periods to reduce without any other commitment. Anglo Platinum being one, and there are a few other large customers who have done their bit. And they're doing it just because they feel that's their contribution to make without affecting production, and they can do it currently. They might not be able to do it in other periods, but right now they can. We have also identified on a short-term basis cross-border generation that could come online in the next year, and we're engaging on that. And I mentioned the demand response aggregator that could ramp up 500 megawatts by July. The next table summarizes the megawatts associated with what I've just said, and as of today we have contracted 1,400 megawatts, of which 1,200 megawatts is operational. So we've managed to secure 1,200 megawatts of levers to help us through this last 2 months. But it's an ongoing process.
Which last 2 months?
The last 2 months as in March, February, March.
Okay.
February, March. Because we did the plan in January and then February, March. The energy conservation scheme, as our colleague mentioned, is something that has been discussed with our various stakeholders. But what Eskom has done is, based on those rules, we've engaged with our top 250 customers to say to them, can you on a voluntary basis at least take part? Out of those 250, 133 of them have voluntarily decided to take part, and 95 of them are some of our largest customers. And if you look at the savings, you can see those 133 are saving 6.4% when we did these measurements. And our largest customers, the 95 large customers, are doing 6.9%. So they're making a significant contribution, and there's some of them in there that are doing more than 10%. Some of the gold mines, for example. So they're really coming to the party, and our message to them should be thank them and say you're doing more than you should, and we shouldn't put pressure on them. We should be targeting those who are not helping, because you'll see that some are not doing, you know, if you look at the overall target, some, all our customers, they're only doing 1%. So there's a big shift that could happen. Our colleague from DOE mentioned a minimum target of 5%. So getting everyone to at least 5% could make a big difference. Our view is that you have to balance impact to the economy, so maybe 10 might, you know, we don't know what the balance is, but there is a shift that can be made. Our studies have said our economy could be as 8 to 15% inefficient, you know, and that could grow up to 30% in some sectors. So there is an opportunity to shift to a more efficient economy without impacting production. And we're asking for people to really think about it. Some of it might require investment. We understand that. But I'm sure there's more that can be done. But we really want to thank those customers who've come to the party on a voluntary basis. This picture, and apologize for the numbers, but I wanted to show you the picture till December, which is our latest prognosis with secured levers. You'll see the picture has improved somewhat on the left-hand side. You'll see a lot more yellow and green and a few weeks of orange. And that is with the secured levers. But to really shift to a more safe environment, we still have to do a bit more. So there's still more to be done. We need to secure that remember, we said up to 2,000 to 3,000 megawatts, and we have secured around 1,200. So there's still a shift that needs to be done. And if we can do that, then we can go back to a safe operating, stable operating power system and ensure all the maintenance we need to do gets done while we wait for the medium-term measures to come in. So that should be our target as a country over the next few weeks and months, to achieve those levers and to shift to a more efficient economy. So we're asking for a partnership. I think one of the ones that everyone can take part in is $49 million. As I mentioned before today, all the SOCs signed up, but this is something that every single individual can take part in. I hope you had the Sunday Times and a few other newspapers this last weekend. We circulated again the stickers. We've gone, Minister of Public Enterprises has helped us by going to some municipalities to help with the campaign, and I'm sure there are many companies now, more and more companies and Chamber of Commerce have signed up. So we're hoping to see some momentum. And we must thank Parliament as well. I think you have signed up last year, I think, and are doing your bit. Conclusions that I want to share with you is, again, just to reiterate that over the next 2 years, we face a fairly tight power system, and it is critical to get through it while we wait for the medium-term measures to kick in. We are running the system at high levels of risk to deal with this backlog so we don't create a longer-term problem. We have to work together as government, Eskom, business, and all citizens to do this. We want to see IPPs come online, either to generate for themselves or through PPAs, and we will give our commitment to support this process, and we'll support the DOE in this process as well. I think a high-level target is to save 10% of our current energy demand and remove 3,000 megawatts. That will make a significant shift to more energy-efficient economy, and we think we can do that. And it will also provide, as I said, for a stable power system. Chair, we've also got a new build update. I think that was a question that you sent to us as well. So let me take you quickly through that as well. If you look at our Eskom's capacity expansion program, we're going to add 17,080 megawatts of new capacity, of which 5,381 megawatts has now been installed and commissioned since the program started in 2004. And when we started also on the transmission network, 4,700 kilometers of line had to be built, and we've done 3,531 kilometers of that. There are new transmission programs that are now coming online, and you've heard about it in the Presidential Infrastructure Commission. This was the original program. There's now a new 10-year plan which calls for a significant amount of new kilometers to be built. This slide gives you the breakdown of how many megawatts in every year since 2004-05, and you can see the 5,381 megawatts. You can see the breakdown of how we built the transmission lines over the last 5-6 years, and how much capacity we've added at our substations, which is 17,920 MVA. And that tells you how much extra capacity we have built to enable distribution to our customers, municipalities and large customers. Going forward to the remaining to make up our 17,000 megawatts of capacity, this is a breakdown per year till 2018-19 of the new build program around the return to service. By the end of the financial year 2012-13, we would have returned all our mothball power stations to service. And then our focus will be on Medupi and Kusile Power Station and Ngula. You've got the Sire Wind Farm in there as well. And what is not here is our pilot concentrated solar power plant, which we have also got funding for that we're building, but it's not on this graph because it was a pilot. This graph just reminds the colleagues and honorable members of the costs associated with the bill, excluding borrowing costs. And you'll see for Medupi, as of our interim results, close to 99 billion rand program for Medupi and 121 billion rand program for Kusile. The benchmark of rand per or dollars per megawatt on this is within world benchmark costs. The Kusile prices are higher because of the delays during this program, and so we've had to pay for that. We're also, on top of the generation program, going to spend 10 billion rand over the next 6 years each year on our distribution network to refurbish, expand, and strengthen it, as well as refurbishing our existing generation fleet. Remember I said it was a mid-year. So to refurbish it, we're spending 82 billion over the next 6 years. So just our investment in the networks, as well as in our existing fleet, is going to be significant, let alone our new fleet. Chair, with that, thank you.
Thank you very much. Of course, what strikes me is a couple of things. The fact that we've already been very keen to actually engage comprehensively on energy efficiency, in Parliament. Because I'm sure all of members, we're still, from our side, I'm still quite uneasy. I still sense some fragmentation in approaching energy efficiency. Anyway, let's see in June when we handle that during the 4 days as to whether really there's a coherent drive, because energy efficiency is not about 49M, it's not about ESCOM together. We'd like to hear what the other parties are doing, and more than anything, how that is coordinated, because the cumulative effect is when there is coordination, you know. Whilst uploading business, which they will come, you know, it's good that you've raised, you know, we would really would like to hear more of what they are doing, you know, in various forms, you know, not just the mining sector, but also various sectors, even agriculture. I'm sure public sector, the public works department will come, you know, and tell us what they are planning to do. And I don't know who will represent Parliament. If I can use my other hat, I've been in the steering committee for climate change. We're just about to launch a greening of Parliament campaign. We've done an audit of our carbon footprint. Please take a deep breath before you get a shock of how much carbon footprint does this Parliament give out. But it's exciting at the end, and at the same time, because we really are going to contribute. You know, we may not be a major contributor, but the thing is, the question, a very simple question, how can we be calling you to come and account and every other when we are, you know, not making any attempt, at least for now, we've started, you know, and thanks to COP17, because it really triggered that energy, and believe you me, by the close of this year, we surely would be doing something, you know, not only honorable members, but each and every person who comes in and out of this parliament, you know, because greening, amongst other things, means, you know, saving energy from one or another. I've already started, you know, every time I leave my office, I make sure that my air conditioner, my computer, and my lights are off. But one thing striking, you know, we may not handle it now because we're going to have the second bite on it, is that with all of these, you know, in reducing, saving and reducing, you know, more electricity, the use of distribution, I know we said the department shouldn't take it, but at the back of our minds, remember, honorable members, that we still are going to have a second fight on electricity distribution industry as a matter of concern. In any case, I'm sure why I even jumped and spoke even before others is because at least the extent to which the ESCOM and the department are articulating their, you know, attempts to mitigate, you know, the threatening or pending interruptions, you know, it is for you to comment. But one of the things I would appeal on the members, if you could do as you make your comments and questions, is that what is it that we can do as a parliament to contribute over and above our own greening? Because that 3,000 megawatt removal is not just the baby of ESCOM and other players. We have, as public representatives, a role to play as well. That said and done, Honorable Smala, followed by Honorable Ross, followed by Honorable Luca, then Honorable Matibela, and Boman.
Yes, Jefferson. I would like to know if there are any in the long-term planning process, because sometimes some of your generating plants gets to a stage where I want to say it's not really cost-effective, it's actually too expensive. And I'm referring to maybe some of your gas turbines. Are you maybe planning, I don't want to say decommission, but maybe just put them aside so that you won't be using them in, you know, in order to get the balance sheets also running effectively, and if there are such implications, maybe forward. Obviously, I would say that you wanted to get your maintenance season or your supply graph with all your peaks, your summer and your winter peaks. You would probably try to get it to a more straighter line. Obviously, there are certain hours and certain days. And I know it's not just your role as ESCOM, but you did went out of your way to go and source more power and buy out power at extraordinary costs. And but that's where corporate governance also, or corporate also needs to come onto board. Where we've got to look at the restructuring of the tariffs in order to make it for the public sector to change business hours, because you can still, there are business and there are public enterprises that can run in the evenings, for instance, you know, change the 9-hour shift to the later part of the 9-hour shift. But why would those businesses do it if there are no such incentives? And this is where the tariffs incentives used to come in. There used to be a tariff in the, until about 3-4 years ago, where businesses that took those tariffs incentives was up to move their business hours to different hours of manufacturing. But those aren't any more there. And what stops ESCOM, what stops the department in order to get to force down those type of tariffs in place in order for us to have a more sustainable power power supply in order to allow Eskom then to do maintenance, because it won't be responsible for the peaking of certain products. You will just maybe don't have to look at the 5,000, 6,000 unit megawatts. You will have to come down. And that is some of the issues that one needs to look at. And I think I want to understand, are there such plans on the table? Are we looking at tariffs? Are we looking at trying to put those incentives out there so that it doesn't cost us money, but that we can get the public sector involved as well? So I'm going to just leave with those two questions. I'll wait for another day. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. Mine is just in regard to the completion dates of Madupi and Kusile. Of course, critical to bridge the 1,000 megawatts that we need. Madupi, the first phase to be completed, is it in 2014? Is it still expected? Is it, has it been shifted to 2015? Do we expect further delays? And then Kusile also, is it in 14 and 15? Is it the 800 megawatts? I'm not sure if I read the schedule correct. But I think that would be critical that we address the 1,000 megawatt shortfall. But first of all, thank you to the presenters, both from the Department of Energy and from Eskom. I think it gives us a very clear indication as to where we are. But my concern is just, I think 2 years ago it was indicated that Eskom has a 12% reserve margin. And I would like to know, what is the international best practice in terms of reserve margins? My information was that it's about 15%. But then we get a 600 megawatt backlash, as to say, from Duval Power Station, and in the press it's reflected as huge problems in terms of our supply, and we need, of course, to see that we put the lights off, so to say, and save electricity. Does it equate to what we really need? And the shortfall of 1,000 megawatts, just in ordinary terms, so how can we explain to the public, is it 9 terawatt hours? Does this equate to the electricity used by Cape Town in 1 year? Is it correct? Is that the shortfall, which is quite critical? It doesn't sound a lot if you take in consideration that we have 42,000 megawatt supply as a maximum capacity and demand about 38 in summer, which gives you about 7.8% in reserve margins. What is our reserve margins? How do we relate to the overseas market in that regard? Chairperson, I think then just in demand market participation agreements, are those the agreements that you were talking about with voluntary cooperation? Is it something else? Is it a sort of a load sharing agreement already enforced? Is it voluntary? Is it mandatory? And the current situation regarding that. Thank you to the presentations. I think it was well done. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think it's time now when all the players are taking it seriously. One of the things, when you talk about power purchase agreements and power buyback, and have you all reached agreements with the people you're buying from? And what's very important is, when you do this, are you considering the environment? Are these deals environmentally friendly? I think that's very important. Getting the electricity, and we're not taking that into account. The other thing is that the efficiency, I think that culture, the chairperson has stated that. And I think we all should do this here, because government buildings, street lighting. And the point I wanted to ask, have you ever thought of daylight savings? Because I think this could work. In countries which are smaller than us have implemented it, it might be a bit of inconvenience, but it could help a lot. And technology, with a 30-year planning, won't technology change in the meantime? Shouldn't we put that into consideration? Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. Mine is just a short one. I don't know whether it goes to the department or to Eskom. We're talking about saving of energy. But since I think the saving started, I think, if I'm not mistaken, 2007 or 2006, somewhere, we were given energy saving bulbs. But these bulbs are very scarce in the market. Why? And instead, I thought by this time, this ordinary bulbs won't be working now. But instead, they are there and they are more expensive as well. But the energy saving are very scarce, especially in maybe in the smaller clean dorpies. I don't know. In Groblestal, it's very scarce. They are very scarce. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair. I have seen this presentation in public enterprises, and I think, yes, we really need to congratulate ESCOM for the work that you are doing in working through this very difficult period, and you have been warning us prior to this that this will be so. I just want to pick up, Chair, what you said, and that is about our part in Parliament in playing a role in assisting here and this partnership. And we have put a question to all our cabinet, our ministers, and those responses that have come back to us, and there are four of them out of 34, only. And but they've come back quite detailed in all the areas in which we can do it. Now, that is multiplied just in this Parliament and the Cabinet, and it goes out there. There can be huge savings. So, you know, I think it is a huge challenge to us in Parliament, and wherever we move and go, and we as parliamentarians are moving out there in many, many places and public spaces. So we can certainly help with this. But mine is really just to pick up on that and to say that we can be in partnership, us here in Parliament. It's a big challenge to us to also be responsible here in how we assist you.
Yes, given the time, let me just say, throw in my lot as well. I think one of the things I checked under the way forward, you said the stakeholder plan. And as I just indicated, challenging this committee first, but every parliamentarian, is that in your stakeholder plan, do you have any component for us, the national parliament, number one, and also there are 9 provincial parliaments. Now, the significance of legislatures is not the quantity they would save, but it's the qualitative impact they would have as public representatives, both at a collective level as legislators, but also at individual level in their constituency. Because by influencing a resident, you're influencing a worker who, when operating a machine, you know, will do that with more, due diligence, rather than just being, nonchalant, if we can call it in English, whether it's an office or whatever. So it has a ripple effect. That's the reason why I keep on raising, indirect in a sense. And that goes with also the information sharing. I've heard you saying a lot about information sharing with stakeholders. I'm not sure whether you people are so used to sharing information with us, to briefings, but I'm sure in this instance, you need to be innovative and ensure that we are part of your treaty, whether it's any other form of better treating, but in an electronic form. We need the update. I don't know how frequently you do that, but it would be helpful in any case. On a lighter note, I've got a brother-in-law who said I must pass this message to you, probably ESCOM, about this, the old bulbs.
you know, he fought, I don't know where, because we wanted the fluorescent bulbs, and he was given the old one. And he hit the roof, and he said, look, Pudi, you must go and tell ESCOM. What are they up to? Fortunately, he's a former employee of ESCOM. He said, what are they up to? In fact, the government is old, you know. I mean, it was a joke, but he was saying, why are we still getting these bulbs in the shelf? Why shouldn't there be a time period that, look, from a certain date, we will not see in the cells, any cells, the old bulbs, period. And it struck me, I mean, it was in a jovial family environment, but it struck me that he is saying something very, very, you know, pertinent. And I think, honorable members, we should keep that in mind and see how it can filter down into you know, the executive side. Maybe your stakeholder involvement, you can raise that as well, you know. Because in any case, I'm sure they are still being manufactured right now as we speak, you know. And the question is, the logic is, that why should they compete with the ones that have been introduced a couple of years ago, you know? Yeah. Anyway, from my side as well, I must say, you know, we've been quite concerned that, you know, getting information through media, you know, it's not official. And at times, at least, it mixes a couple of other things, you know, and when we get it from the horse's mouth, both ESCOM and the department, it's helpful. We know that it's official. We can take it anywhere, you know, energy saving, you know, also, you know, ensuring that there's adequate, you know, energy, particularly during peak times. Is very, very important. I think also I must applaud Honorable Smala for the area issue that he raised, the incentives to shift business hours. You know, I'm going to listen to that, you know, with great interest. You know, we never thought of that. Over to you.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair. Let me first start with information sharing, because I think that's important. Just to let you know that on Facebook and Twitter, for those who are following, we do have ESCOM SA, and we have a Facebook page that gives system updates. And our ESCOM website also has system updates, as well as a review of our past performance on a weekly basis and a prognosis going forward for a quarter. So if you ever need to, that's it. But what I understand is to see how we can be more innovative. We'll take that challenge up and work with our colleagues in DPE to see how we can shade in a different way, and maybe we'll test a few ideas with yourselves. So we'll take a note of that and figure it out. But in the interim, if you do want to, we have, and you can do it by province, we've got Eastern Cape, KwaZulu-Natal, Western Cape, especially if you want to look at their status. So we have that information. We probably maybe have to spend more time. We have been with the Minister of Public Enterprises visiting the premiers and provincial governments of province by province to see how we can partner with the Chamber of Commerce, with the Parliament, with the provincial governments and so on, but we probably haven't spent enough time with Parliament. So maybe that's a gap. I think that is a gap we need to think about as well, to see if we can do more. I'll also deal with the CFLs. As ESCOM, as you know, we have rolled out the biggest biggest campaign of a CFL rollout in the world, 47 million light bulbs. We're now doing a sustainability rollout of taking out at least 5 million light bulbs. And my colleague, Solofela Molefe, is accountable for that. And we've been doing that to reach the places where these bulbs have come back. The challenge is currently there's no legislation to say you can't put in incandescent. So retailers are saying, you know, if our competitor doesn't do it, we will not do it. And we're trying to engage with them to say on a voluntary basis, can you do it? There's one or two retailers that are coming to the party, but most of them are saying you can't force us if somebody else is doing it. So we lose our sales. So I think it's important to make a call of when we do that. But in the interim, what we're doing is doing a residential rollout. And we've just launched a residential rollout also to replace downlighters, putting geyser switches. And we started it as a pilot, and you might have seen it in the newspapers yesterday or today, where we finished the first phase for 45 megawatts. and it has shown promising results, and we're seeing if we can ramp it up. And we're essentially offering the residential market a free service to replace these products. And we've piloted it. If it works, we're going to roll it out further. So that's on top of what we've done with the light bulbs for residential markets. We have in the past done work on daylight savings, and that was a few years back. And at that time, it didn't seem to have a significant benefit, but it has been raised again. And we're very open to listening to new research. We'll try to do our own. But if anyone has ideas on done the studies, we're welcome to give it to us. Our own studies initially didn't show the great benefit, but again, we'll look at that again. And it was brought up during the the IRP discussions as well. Let me talk about PPAs and power buybacks. We have actually, the ones that I presented to you are actually signed and delivering. So we have signed the agreements and it has delivered. They're delivering megawatts. As Eskom, we are committed to an integrated reporting structure. So we report across three areas, socioeconomic, environmental, financial as well. And you'll see that, and we talk about our carbon footprint. So when we do this, we eventually translate it to an integrated report. Not all of it, I mean, some of the PPAs are with coal producing. The power buyback does reduce your carbon emissions, so you know you have a plus and minus. But we are working within our government policy and the long-term trajectory of the Integrated Resource Plan, which says that our goal as Eskom, but also the country, is to firstly reduce our relative emissions per kilowatt hour, and we're on track, and then over time to reduce our absolute emissions. The speed at which we do that is based on affordability. You know, we have to trade off many things, technology, localization, and that is a big discussion in the RP. But at Eskom, we're committed to reduce relative and then over time absolute emissions, and we are taking that into account. And that goes hand in hand with technology changes. The challenge with the electricity industry is because our lead times are so long, you have to commit to some technologies 10 years ahead of time. By the time you built it, there's something new that could have been done. So it's a trade-off. And the challenge we have in the planning sphere is what do you commit to and where do you have flexibility? And those are the decisions that government has to make now around which projects we implement, which ones can we wait a little longer to see if there are alternative technologies. But there's no doubt in our mind that we're shifting to a more distributed generation industry where there will be more distribution closer to the demand. We'll have smart grids, we'll have more distributed grids, and we need to gear up for that. And we are doing work to figure out how to do that, to be more flexible. But that's where technology is going. And commercial and residential customers especially will have more choice about how they provide power. Large industrial customers will still want backup, they want a strong grid. So how do you mix those two? We see that's where we're going. Just in terms of demand market participation, demand market participation is a trend that started in Australia, New Zealand, the UK, and America. It's about saying sometimes customers can provide cheaper negative generation and build in new capacity. And how do you tap into that market? And we started doing it with our large customers. It's an incentive-based program. It's not forced. It's not mandatory. Where we say there's a price which is cheaper than our gas turbines, are you willing to offer some of your demand that we can call on instead of running gas turbines, for example? And we've been doing it for several years, since about 2003-04, with our large customers, and all we're saying is it's worked well, can we extend it to our larger customers? For example, in the US, in the last 3 years, that's where they've got their biggest capacity. They haven't actually built a new plant. They've used demand market products instead of capacity. And renewables is the other market. It actually goes hand in hand also with renewables. You can balance the variability of renewables with demand market products. So we're trying to introduce a new product into our electricity market. In terms of the completion dates of Medupi and Kusile, we've said previously in this forum that we had anticipated that Medupi's first unit will now be in the second half of 2013, and our concern at that time was the delays in the boiler erection. We had significant concerns with our contractor in that regard. We mentioned again in Parliament that they had given a commitment of May 2013, but for planning purposes we said we'll keep to the second half of 2013. the RFP called for first commissioning in April 2013. So based on that, we're still saying it should be in the second half of 2013, and we'll come back to you if things improve, either through Parliament or when we do our financials, we'll update the situation. Kusile, if you look at it, was for December 2014, was the public date, and we haven't changed those dates. In terms of tariffs, as Eskom, we have time of use tariffs for our large consumers. So they do have an incentive, and also seasonal tariffs. So they have an incentive to shift some of the production, but, and even our municipalities have a, so we charge our municipalities on time of use. I think their challenge is how to translate that to their customers. And that is a disconnect, and that is something maybe the DOE or COFTA can comment on. Of our 4 million customers, 4.3 million customers, there are some we've piloted on time of use, but very small. The remaining are prepaid customers that don't have time of use. A large percentage, 4 million of our customers are prepaid, so we don't have time of use for them. To shift it to time of use could incur significant costs in terms of change in metering. And so it's something we're debating. The regulator has required us to move towards smart metering over a certain period of time, which then allows you to do time of use. But it might be restricted to the higher end consumers. And Eskom is a limited number. We've only got a few hundred thousand. The majority of them, over nearly 2 million, sit within municipalities who would be affected by that. So the bigger challenge is actually in the municipalities, and we need to talk about that with them. Do we put aside some of our generation? Ideally, the gas turbines that we have built, gas turbines are very cheap to build, very quick to build, but if you run them, they're very expensive. So what you want is, you want them as an insurance policy, and you only want to run them 1 hour a day. When you run them more than that, that's when they become expensive. Otherwise, they're the right choice for the peak. And that's where we want to get them to run. To run them just for the 1 to 2 hours over peak period, and ideally even shift from diesel to gas if we can find gas. So that's the, over time, that's maybe where we should go to. And other options instead of them are demand market participation, or pump storage schemes where you use water. So those are the choices that in the RFP are discussed. The other plant, other coal-fired stations, we have no intent to decommission them earlier than planned. They have a 50 to 60-year life cycle. The return to service plans have about a 25-year life cycle. And we keep monitoring them, but at this stage, there's no plans to decommission them any earlier. We intend to run them as planned. So those are some of the options. So thank you. I've answered, I think, the question.
Chair, perhaps just to add a little. And I will respond to only one particular question, and that relates to running of the diesel turbines over a prolonged period. Chair, currently the department is working on the what we refer to as the gas strategy. And one of the considerations is that we want to displace diesel being used as an energy input on these OCGTs with gas. We have heard that there are pockets of gas in the country, but there is no coordinated strategy on how we bring all of that into the electricity mix. So there is a strategy document that we are working on, and one of the intentions is that we will replace the diesel with this gas in the country.
Okay.
Okay. Of course, I have not been able earlier because of time to raise issues I could have raised with the other people. But it must be noted that as we talk about alternative forms of electricity, we're coming from different angles. We are looking at electricity from an angle that we would like to arrive at universal access. But local government comes from the angle that they want to raise revenue with electricity. It's so much that as we talk about renewable energy and as we talk about free basic energy, to them we're talking about how much less their revenue will be. And these are the people, the agencies we expect to see implementing the decisions we make. We need to look at that because FFC mentioned it in their slides today, that to local government, their research shows that the implementation of FBE, FBAE, and the intensity of renewables is actually affecting them in terms of revenue collection.
Did you say that there's going to be a return of all mothballed fire stations?
Yes, Chair, we had three mothballed stations, Komati, Grootvlei, and Camden. Their combined capacity at the time of mothballing was just over 3,000 megawatts. The other power stations that we decommissioned at that time, in the 80s and 70s, or 80s, were decommissioned and then dismantled and sold for scrap. But those three were mothballed in case we had to return them. Those three by the financial year 2012-13 will have all been fully recommissioned. Camden has already been fully recommissioned. Grootvlei is nearly done. And Komati will be the last station. And we're confident that by the end of the financial year 2012-13, all three stations will be fully on the bus. And the expected lifespan based on coal availability and so on is about 25 years.
I remember that. Something that I almost slipped my mind. Swane is around. Welcome, Swane. We actually, I invited Swane and Joker because they are the two municipalities that generate their own electricity. Can Swane just give us in 5-10 minutes what they are doing to ensure that they also join the, or they've already joined the band record to minimize interruption of power. Actually, it will probably give us an idea what role a municipality is aiming to do. Hopefully, Sana can articulate that.
Thanks, Sir President. My name is Robert Musongani. In fact, I understand, maybe I should give an introduction that I just started acting in this position. The power purchase agreement that has been signed, I'm just aware that there is such that has been signed. And now we are working on to ensure that we do reach the target, to ensure that we generate the energy.
Let's hear about the target, not just the target. How much?
I don't have the figure with me here, but I think the colleague from Eskom possibly has the right figure that has been signed, because I don't have it with me here. The other issues of rolling out the solar water geysers, we are doing that. We do have quite a number that of solar water geysers that we are doing, and the retrofitting of street lights and the changing of robots to ensure that we decrease the consumption or the load. In that one, we are complying fully. So, yeah, I think that's all that I can say for now. Thank you.
Sorry, it was a tail end, but how I wish we would have had Joe Jonas as well. However, honourable members, I'm sure will agree, when we go into the energy efficiency 4-day session, we'll have to invite Salga again and also the metros as much as possible, because we have to know to what extent are municipalities on their own playing their role to save electricity. To what extent are they taking some of the issues that Eskom is doing, you know? Of course, they're customizing them to a municipal environment. But from all I heard today, honorable members, is that now that Eskom and the department have articulated the extent to which they're trying to sail through the trying period before we have the three power stations fully commissioned. That's quite settling, not necessarily convincing.
We have to be cautious on that. And I can sense from the Portfolio Committee for Public Enterprise, they've already made that presentation, and to quite an extent, you really were quite settled as well, that you can sense that they are quite seized, fairly seized with this program. There are drop-off things, and not only are they doing their best to ensure that electricity is saved as much as possible, all other innovative and creative means are done to ensure that we enhance utilization of electricity during this period. But also, we'll be able to get an update, more frequently than it used to be. I think on that basis, let us thank ESCOM, let us thank the department as well as FANES. We had a sense that you do work with ESCOM, and our wish would have actually received some indication in terms of the electricity that you generate on your own. How does it work out? Yes, I understand the power purchase agreement, but, as I say, in any case, we'll handle it down the line to hear from the municipalities how they intend or currently engage in the optimal utilization or production of electricity. On that note, can I thank everyone? It has been a very, very long day. See you tomorrow, honorable members, for those who will be seeing you when we get our briefing from NEXA and NNR. Thank you very much for the meeting.
Unfortunately, I have to take the people out of the country. Grand Jews are the chief people of the family.